What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
Hi.
Hi. Are you like one of those lunatics who just sits next to a complete stranger in an empty movie theater?
You look so familiar to me.
I mean, it's possible we've met, but you just don't have a very memorable face.
It's possible that's the line Rooney Mara gives any random dude bold enough to talk to her. In this case, it's Jason Segel with Mara in a scene from The Discovery, the new indie sci-fi film from writer-director Charlie McDowell.
The Discovery of the title? Scientific Proof of the Afterlife. The film played to some acclaim at Sundance earlier this year and made its debut last weekend on Netflix. This week on the show, a review of The Discovery and results from the Film Spotting Madness Final Four.
It's all ahead.
Madness! I tell you, it's madness!
On Film Spotting. Yes, Josh, it is Rooney Mara. I've been saying Mara recently on the show. I confuse myself yet again. Her family says Mara, but Rooney, for whatever reason, prefers Mara.
Mara.
From what I have ascertained.
Yes.
That's what we're going with. Rooney Mara, we'll get to her here in a little bit.
I've ascertained that because that's how we have it in the Film Spotting pronunciation guide.
That's
and once
right.
It goes in there, you can't change it.
Yeah. You can't unlock that thing. You got to listen to last week's show as a fan.
I did.
Me, Michael Phillips, he was filling in for you. We did a little Sacred Cow on Casablanca, Film Spotting Madness. Casablanca went down. Citizen Kane went down. The Godfather 2 and even Vertigo went down. How did you take all that?
I figured it was going to happen to Casablanca, so I'm glad that it got the attention you guys gave. Catherine Fusco, who joined you guys, was great. We got to find another reason to have her on.
Absolutely.
Maybe that's a good excuse to do another classic Sacred Cow at some point here in the future. But I liked that. Mostly I liked Michael's addition to Film Spotting Madness, pairing movies against fruit. Was it like a bowl of grapes?
I don't remember.
I think that's what it was. It makes about as much sense to me as what we've been doing. So yeah, maybe next year we'll throw that in.
So it did get a little ugly last week with the madness, but we did get down to the final four. In the two semifinal matchups, we had The Godfather going up against 2001 A Space Odyssey and Pulp Fiction against The Empire Strikes Back. Later in the show, those results and the two films that'll duke it out in the championship round. Plus, podcast listeners will get the fourth film in our Agnes Varda marathon, 1985's Vagabond.
Little tease, it's my favorite of the marathons so far. First, though, after butting heads over Charlie McDowell's debut feature, The One I Love, can Adam and I find common ground on The Discovery?
Don't you think your discovery was just too dangerous to share with the world?
Isla! Isla!
How can you keep a discovery so vital to our existence a secret?
You proved the existence of an afterlife.
I prefer to call it a new plane of existence.
Do you feel responsible for all those people killing themselves?
We opened the door for these people. Now we have to show them what's behind it.
First, Adam, because we did split on Charlie McDowell's The One I Love, and I was the one who had issues with it, I want to assure you I did everything I could to give The Discovery, McDowell's second film, a fighting chance. So I intentionally didn't revisit my review of The One I Love. I couldn't really remember my issues with the film, and I didn't want those clouding my perception of The Discovery.
They were misguided anyway.
I did recall that The One I Love centered on a high concept with sci-fi trappings, and The Discovery does the same. After reclusive neuroscientist Thomas Harbour, played by Robert Redford, proves the existence of an undefined afterlife, a rash of suicides breaks out around the world. The count is up to some 4 million by the time the movie proper is underway. This motivates Harbour's estranged son, Will, played by Jason Segel, to track him down at his island estate, where he finds more experiments underway and also meets a cynical mystery woman named Isla, played by Rooney Mara. Now, in my effort at goodwill, I chose to overlook an instantly nagging question. Given that Harbor has discovered only that something lies beyond death, but not any details about what that something might be, it seems unlikely that so many people would be in a rush to get there.
Maybe.
Still, I hope the discovery was simply using the conceit as a launching point for something more thoughtful. I'll get to the results of my particular experiment in critical objectivity, Adam, but first I want to hear your thoughts. You probably didn't have to work so hard to create a level playing field for the discovery. Are you still on the Charlie McDowell bandwagon?
Yeah, it's the opposite, though. Maybe I had too high expectations. Your question, in some ways, is a variation on my question, if you recall, from our summer movie preview. I think it was my number one. I asked which sci-fi flick will mark its second-time director as my new favorite, The Discovery, or Annihilation, which is the film coming out later this year, I believe, from Alex Garland, who gave us Ex Machina, a film.
Which might come up here.
Yeah, we loved so much last year. Let's just say, Josh, the bar is now significantly lower for Garland.
Mm.
He may have an easier time in terms of vaulting up that list for me as my new favorite director. But look, I'm absolutely still in on McDowell because of how much I appreciate The One I Love. I certainly encourage everyone out there who hasn't seen that movie yet to see it. And because of the ambition of his ideas. Both movies, you mentioned The High Concept, they present these kind of Twilight Zone meets Ray Bradbury scenarios that are fascinating to me. And I guess as I think of sci-fi short stories, it's appropriate that we have here two characters that are really obviously named Will, as in free will, which is a topic that does come up in various forms. And Isla, the Rooney Mara character, who is an island unto herself.
An island on an island.
Yes. And she is on an island throughout almost the entire movie, and she has this obsession or preoccupation, I should say, with water. So we get where those names come from. But in terms of the ambition, I didn't even consider when I threw out on that summer preview, when I read the scenario, I didn't even consider that it might go where McDowell and his writing partner, Justin Leiter, may take this. The one sentence synopsis then was a love story set 1 year after the existence of the afterlife is scientifically verified. And as you mentioned, where they then take it is that causes such a seismic shift in everyone's sense of reality and their place in this world that they actually consider, well, maybe I'm so unhappy here or so curious, or I have perhaps loved ones in this other plane of existence that I'd rather be there. And people start killing themselves en masse. Whether or not we totally buy it, we can talk about. But I like that concept, or I like the notion of that concept in the movie exploring that. And I think certainly comparisons to McDowell based on these two films will be made to Charlie Kaufman and films like The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Of course, there's some Christopher Nolan and Inception going on here as well. But the movie I had in mind at the end of the film, considering all the ways this movie didn't work, and I wonder if this will at all seem appropriate to you, was The Lobster, one of our favorite movies from last year. I think actually in your top 10
of
the year. It had nothing to do initially with the fact that you could argue both are movies about people transitioning from one of these planes of existence to another, filled with uncertainty. In The Lobster, it's people transitioning into becoming animals. It was mostly just about tone. Both are inherently kind of absurd, with moments of quirk and dark humor. And at the end of The Discovery, the question that I was asking myself, that I was going to make myself answer, was why does The Lobster so totally work tonally, and this doesn't really at all work? And I came up with a few thoughts, and I don't know if you'll have any thoughts as well, but I think a big part of it is the casting, mainly of Jason Segel. I don't think he's as talented an actor or as strong of a presence as Colin Farrell. I think, in fact, Colin Farrell in the film The Discovery would immediately elevate it and make it a better film. We can talk about Segel maybe a little bit more as well. I think this film also never fully commits to the absurdity. So the moments that could be funny instead just feel really out of place and fall flat. There's also too much actual sadness and grief in this film that's in conflict with that absurdity. And the other thing I came up with, and it does connect back to these other two points, is in The Lobster, even though Colin Farrell's character is walking into a space he's never been in before, he's going to this resort where all the people who hit a certain age and haven't gotten married yet have to go, and it's their last shot before they get turned into an animal, though an animal of their choice, he is part of this world. He feels connected to it. Everyone understands more or less what they're getting into. And here we have the Segel character, Will, as this outsider walking onto this island, walking into this whole new crazy absurd world that his father, the scientist, has built. And he's so serious and he's so skeptical of it that we, seeing this world through his eyes, we also then are overly serious and overly skeptical. And I think that transfers onto us in a way that makes us overly question every decision that's made in this film, including every decision that character makes. By the end of the film, it really doesn't add up to much, unfortunately.
The Lobster is a great comparison, and it didn't come to mind to me. Ex Machina did, and they both illustrate, I think, one of the main problems that I had, at least, with The Discovery. This is a movie that, as you've suggested, poses a lot of questions. Some of these are ones that Will is asking about his father's work. Some of them are related to the mystery of the background of the Isla character, and some of them, primarily, most of them are related to the nature of this afterlife and discovering more things about it, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with you that McDowell has admirable ambition and really intriguing ideas. I think you could say the same of something like The Lobster and something like Ex Machina. They both give you plots, premises that you could say in one mm-hmm. sentence and you're like, ooh,
yeah,
intrigued.
You're interested.
Okay. Those two movies use the premise to set the stage. And both here and I do think in The One I Love, McDowell makes the premise the stage. That's all it is. So in other words, take Ex Machina, for example. Is she a robot or isn't she, essentially, is what we're wondering. But really, that's just the way we get into this exploration of ambition and identity and human consciousness.
Yes, what all makes of these, you a human?
And just in the background is the fact, is that basic question.
Mm-hmm.
The Discovery is all about answering all of these questions. It never gets behind them. Throwing 20 more on. It keeps burrowing deeper and deeper and deeper into its premise. So I think what happens here is it's not the issue so much even that it becomes more confusing. Okay. I'm all right with that. I like a certain degree of vagueness. And you mm-hmm. could argue that The Lobster is more vague about the particularities of its plot, and Ex Machina perhaps too. The more answers we get here
yes.
don't really help because it's not allowing us to explore the things we might be more interested in. So in other words, it doesn't matter if The Discovery doesn't add up. Except for the fact that the movie is all about whether or not it adds up.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's setting itself a trap there. A, that's not very interesting. It's just more plot mechanics. And B, when it doesn't pull that off in the end, and it might for some people, but when it doesn't, like it didn't for me, then it doubly fails in a way.
Yeah.
And speaking to giving the movie a chance, I mean, there is a big explanation scene that Mara gives. Debbie and I watched this again right after the movie because we were both like, okay, I mean, we're intrigued by the ideas. We're like,
right.
Let's try to figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
Watched it again, pieced together a few more things, spent a good 20 minutes after the movie was over like, okay, so this meant this and this meant that. And we're like, okay, we think we get it. The next morning, did the same thing. Like, I thought maybe, you know, overnight, this struck me. Maybe normally that would be good about a movie, that you want to keep wrestling with it and talking about it and trying to figure it out. Here, it just continued to be frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
And again, not because we didn't get an answer, but because if you don't get the answer, there's not much else here.
No, there isn't. And I think I'm going to end up saying basically what you just said, but you're right. By the end of this film, when we talk about ambition with ideas and provocative questions, the ending here is both kind of confusing and completely understandable in a way, actually, that I think is a little bit too obvious. It lays everything out for you. Mara's character certainly does.
I think it makes emotional sense what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So
yes.
For the characters, we can go away feeling they have reached a certain type of closure. We don't understand exactly how that happened, even though the movie spent the majority of its time trying to show us how.
Right. But I do think the bigger problem here, this gets back to what you were saying about the premise and the questions that are then provoked by that premise. This one doesn't leave you with any real questions to ponder at the end other than the mechanics of how it worked.
Totally.
And that's not satisfying. The questions about what we're seeing and why we're seeing it aren't enough. It should be all the questions that come after, the ones you have to think about personally. A movie like another sci-fi movie that confounded a lot of people recently was The Arrival.
I
think The Arrival.
I did think of The Arrival.
Okay, that's a film that leaves you thinking about things that we discussed in a little spoiler talk beyond just what the hell actually happened.
And that's a very good example, because that's one where I was confused by it. Mm-hmm. Yet in the end, sure, I wish I hadn't been confused, but I didn't hold it completely against the movie because there were other things
to still latch wrestle onto. With. And the one I love, for me, is another example. McDowell has done it. He's pulled it off with this premise and these provocative questions. I know it came up when we talked about that film and I mentioned it on Letterboxd, but at the end of The One I Love, without spoiling anything at all, my wife turned to me and said, "What would it take to make the best version of me?" And I just said, "Exactly." Because, of course, I didn't want to answer her question, but that's the question that, among other questions, I think anyone watching that film, if the movie has worked for you at all, that's what you're thinking about. And that is a fascinating question to think about. There are many with that film, but thinking about your relationships and your dynamics with your significant other, that's what was so great about that film for me. So he's done it,
but this time
the premise consumes him.
It's almost a matter of overthinking it, though, because you're right. That was a great thing to latch onto in The One I Love, and I remember it hitting that. There's sort of a reveal, like a twist there, hitting it there, and then continuing on where there were more complications and more explanations after that. So you almost want the guy to cut his great idea in half, you know, and say, okay, you've got the great idea. Just use that and go somewhere else with it. Don't keep, as I said, burrowing into it. Mm-hmm. And I think there are some indications here with The Discovery, look, comparing it to The One I Love, where he's making steps forward in other areas that we might get a movie that is at that point. I think this is visually a bit more interesting than The One I Love. Not that The One I Love was, you know, ugly or anything like that, but the setting alone
it's much prettier than this film, which is
intentionally.
Really distinctly bleak.
This is so bleak. It's like, you know, obviously set on an island and you feel the whole thing has been doused with salt water. You know, everything's just kind of damp and gloomy. Mm-hmm. And I liked how that persisted all the way through the interior scenes. I mean, there's some great production design on this vast estate that the Redford character has taken over. I love how all of his equipment is out of date by maybe a decade or two, the medical equipment. And then it's also placed in these drawing rooms and halls that are like centuries old. And so it's like doubly dated what's going on here, which is a nice twist on the usual sort of sleek sci-fi setting we might otherwise get. And I also think there's some great camera work and imagery in the moment where Will submits himself to his father's brain scanning machine, just the way things are turned upside down.
Key image of the film.
It is the key image, but it's carried through in the scene that it happens as well. And I thought of like Hal 9000 with tentacles. It's like the machine almost becomes alive in a way that's very intriguing. So I think there are some indications. You just wish, you know, maybe if McDowell placed a little less emphasis on his plot and looked at things like production design or the visual scheme or even performance. We should spend some more time on the performances. I actually think, I don't know if Mara and Siegel give better performances, but I think they create a better space here, I found, to do something. The One I Love, it was just hard for me. And you know, I love Elizabeth Moss, to watch an actor just having to jump through the plot mechanics, which is how I read that. And here, there's a lot of that too. Don't get me wrong, but it goes back to your note about tone. I think Siegel and Mara both do find a comfortable place in the mordant humor that is here. And you're right that it conflicts with the sadness in a lot of ways, but their best scenes together involve that dark humor. And they create at least this little emotional zone that they can share that is apart from getting bounced around by what has to happen next to explain to us what's going to happen after that.
What's wrong with you?
I'm processing.
Oh. I mean, do you ever get out of your head even for 1 minute? Okay, let's do an experiment. Look at me. Look at me and tell me the first thing that comes to your mind.
I'm driving. Okay. I don't know you very well. I think you're beautiful and alive. And if you killed yourself, it wouldn't just be sad. It would be a tragedy.
Shut up.
Do they have good scenes together? I certainly had no problem with Duplass and Elizabeth Moss in The One I Love, but here,
I think they do.
From the beginning of the film, this is the first time in a long time. I don't remember the last time I actually ever had this note about a movie on this show where I was keenly aware from the moment an actor stepped on screen that he was completely miscast.
Hmm.
Siegel simply cannot bring the type of nuance, the type of intellectual curiosity. And I'm not basing this on any perception of him as an actor because of TV. I didn't really watch How I Met Your Mother. I have seen, of course, Forgetting Sarah Marshall. I think he's really good in that film. I liked him in The End of the Tour, playing, I suppose, a more serious role there. I like him as an actor, so it's nothing about him. I just think he is working against the material every single moment of this film. And when you spend more time actually watching other actors and you're paying attention to what they're doing with their performance and how they are pulling off their performances despite the material, that's a problem. I think Rooney Mara does that here, where every scene I was aware of her bringing a depth to the role and bringing a depth then to the film that the material simply doesn't support in anything they're saying or doing in those moments. And I do think that, I mentioned Colin Farrell, if you had someone, and I'm just throwing out two obvious names, and of course they're both British, so you think of more stature, I suppose, but if a Hiddleston or a Fassbender was in this role instead of Jason Segel, I think it would immediately actually almost convince us that the material's better than it is simply because they would bring more heft to it than Siegel's able to bring here.
Well,
you just can't pull it off.
Oh, okay, but you're saying Hiddleston and Fassbender are better actors than Jason Segel is essentially what you're saying. Yes, they would elevate this material.
I think they probably are.
I think basically they're all working against the material. And what I found was that Segel and Mara were both good at the same time and both bad at the same time.
Yeah,
that
I never
opening
felt that.
Scene that the meet cute, so to speak, is it goes on forever and is so strained, and neither of them are good there. They're playing clear single beats of emotion, both of them. And types, really. She's more of a type than he is, actually, at that point.
Yeah.
I think there are moments, again, where they find some point of connection amidst the sadness, usually with humor. There's the nice little line, they're sharing bunk beds in this estate, and she says, hold my hand, and he's on top, so he has to reach down.
He says what we're all thinking, which is, it doesn't seem fair. He has to reach up. She gets to reach down.
And it's just, and they don't comment on that any further. That's right. A much better point of connection than when we get to the obligatory lovemaking scene,
that's
which
only maybe
no
the good
one
moment
is,
in the film.
No one is going to buy.
No. And speaking of not buying, there are so many
and
moments
it doesn't
I
have to
buy.
Happen. It doesn't have to be a romance.
Well, except it's very clear, and I'm sure he didn't write the premise, but when I quoted that one sentence premise earlier, a love story, it's very clear.
Would you
clear.
Describe it that way, having
no,
seen
but,
it, though?
But I would, this is why the movie doesn't work. I would say that there's no doubt to me that the director and his co-screenwriter very much thought they were making a romance.
Oh,
that
sure.
They were making a love story that then doesn't work because, partly, Siegel's not good enough. They don't have any chemistry together whatsoever. And I just simply didn't buy any of that. And so when characters like Siegel's character late in this film make a very big, profoundly life-changing decision, all because of his feelings for her, didn't go along with it for a second. I didn't buy that. There are so many other things I didn't buy with this film. There's certain decisions that the Robert Redford character makes, where earlier in the film,
yeah, we should talk about Redford.
He's been so adamant about sharing his discovery with the world. He has a new discovery to share. I understand why he is hesitant to share this new discovery, but the movie just expects us to buy that after all of this, sticking to his commitment to science, he's in this moment much more willing to abandon it. There are so many genres and different tropes competing with each other here. He actually becomes, or we see him very early becoming, this Kurtzian type figure on this compound where everyone is looking up to him and looking to him for guidance. And nothing interesting really comes of that at all. You actually realize later it's just a plot device. I think it's just there, again, to move the plot forward. So that doesn't satisfy at all. And there are a lot of awkward and unintentionally funny moments in this film in a way that I never experienced with The One I Love. I'll give you one example. It's just the most glaring example, but there are a lot of little beats like this that don't work in this film where Mara and Siegel are on an investigation. And this is where the movie is getting a little more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You want to see how this is going to play out. You want the same answers they're seeking. They go to meet with a woman who they don't know, and they're asking her about her brother who had passed away like a decade before. And they position themselves as people who maybe knew him or met him briefly and kind of liked him. And she clearly has much more ambivalent feelings to straight up anger towards her brother. And she goes on this mini rant where she says, look, I don't know what he told you. you guys apparently seem to like him, but to any of us who knew him, he was a piece of shit.
Mm-hmm.
She's defiant. She's angry. And in that moment, there's this tiny pause, and then it cuts to Siegel, and he's like, so the last time you saw him was when? It's like that. It's basically that exchange where anyone else, any other human being in that moment, would take in her anger mm-hmm. and emotion and have some empathy with it and try to figure out then how to connect with her further and ultimately get the answers they want. But instead, he just blurts out the one thing that is on his mind.
It's not a very smooth inquisition overall, that whole sequence. I want to go back to Redford because I was looking at his credits and he's done more than just cameos lately. Of course, All Is Lost, maybe the biggest example, but I'm thinking of something like Pete's Dragon.
You're such a Redford hater
these
days.
Of an extended cameo. And what else have I complained about Redford?
Well, you didn't like him in Pete's Dragon, as I recall.
Well, here's what he's doing. And there, it's less of a problem because it is an extended cameo. You arrive on set, you give your pronouncement and bring your gravitas and your presence and you leave. Well, someone should have told him here, he has a supporting part. Because all he does is make pronouncements, whether it's in the Kurtz mode or in the fatherly mode. There is no give and take here.
Isn't that the writing and the directing, though?
This goes back to the material. Yeah. So here's where I'm defending Siegel and Mara, because and primarily Siegel, because I just think you're dealing with things where the first point is to move along the idea, the premise, to the point where everything else is getting left by the wayside while McDowell is pursuing the nooks and crannies of his plot. And so, yeah, you don't weave in. This is where actors are not going to connect. I don't know that Redford is trying much, again, because you get to this stage of your acting career and you can do this. You can pop in movies and everyone will say how wonderful you are because you gave a speech and you leave. He just gives a ton of speeches here.
Yeah, he does.
Essentially. And that doesn't help. What, again, should be one of – there are potential very interesting things here about regret.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, honestly, the idea of the afterlife is sort of set aside.
Yeah.
But it pursues things faintly that really could have been the heart of the movie. And you could have come away and
said – could have been its own separate movie.
And it should have been.
Yeah.
And it didn't need all of this extra plot. It basically needed the premise and maybe one more little twist. And instead – focus on the character relationships. Focus on the emotional fallout of the premise that you've set up. But when you push that premise to the front of the stage, everything else, performances, theme, any sort of intrigue just gets lost in the dark in the background.
Yeah. Performance-wise, I think Redford
Jesse
is
Plemons.
Fine. Jesse Plemons. That's where I'm going. I'm not going to leave that out.
This is the most damning thing about the movie.
How good he is?
No.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
Terrible.
No, he's so good.
I love him every
too.
Time he shows
every
up on
time.
Screen. He has never been this ticky because there's nothing for him to work with
but
here.
He's one of those actors, and again, we often disagree on ticky or quote-unquote big performances. He's actually a very sedate character, but he is very ticky. I give you that, and yet it's way more interesting and believable in every moment on screen because he's just naturally that gifted as an actor.
I was about to hand him a rubber band to tie up his hair if he was not going to stop.
If he rubbed it one more time,
off his forehead.
I get
and
where you're coming from.
This is a guy who doesn't need to do a thing to be the most interesting character on the screen.
I think he felt like he had to. I think he felt like he had to
because of the material.
Yes, I'm with you, and still I enjoyed watching him. I thought he gave an actual believable performance, despite all those ticks. So I hear what you're saying on Plemons, but I think you're completely wrong. The Discovery is out now in limited release, and it is playing on Netflix. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Final four results for Film Spotting Madness when we come back. I believe we're going to find out which of the two of us still has a shot to win this thing and which one is the definite loser. Is that right?
Am I smiling?
Oh, geez.
I'm sorry, am I smiling?
Great. Also, our Agnes Varda marathon continues with 1985's Vagabond. I thought I'd seen the best of Varda in Cleo from 5 to 7. Turns out, I might have been wrong. Stay with us.
There was a wayward land stepped out one morning. The ground to be his bed, the sky his awning.
Neon, neon. blue neon lamp in a midnight country field. Gauss around, so you lean on, lean on. So much has become hold of.
What's the secret, Max?
The secret?
Yeah, well, you seem to have it pretty figured out.
Secret, I don't know. I think you just gotta find something you love to do and then do it for the rest of your life. For me, it's going to Rushmore.
Jason Schwartzman and Bill Murray in 1998's Rushmore. Next week, we've got the perfect excuse to revisit Wes Anderson's second film for our Sacred Cow review. It's because, Josh, as we've been promoting here over the past few weeks, you are going to be participating and you're going to be leading a discussion at Ebert Interruptus. It's part of the Conference on World Affairs. I remember hearing these stories about Ebert watching Citizen Kane and going through it frame by frame. Now that's going to be you, and you're talking about Rushmore. How many times have you watched it in preparation, or are you just going in blind?
Well, if I don't get my act together, I'm going in blind because I've got a couple days here and I've yet to revisit it. But this is a movie that's kind of constantly playing in my head in the background anyway. So I'm not too worried about that, but I am going to take another look. And I was talking to Michael J. Casey over the weekend. He's the Boulder film critic who helps organize this event and invited me. And he said, he was encouraging. He's basically like, you're the admiral of the ship. You just got to keep the ship on course. Most people are going to be jumping in, making observations, you know, yelling stop, want to point something out. And you just got to make sure things keep moving ahead. Throw in a few things here and there. I'm not going to have to go there and give a lecture. That's not the nature of this sort of thing. It sounds basically like it's just going to be a lot of fun. So yeah. I can't wait to do it. I was never able to go all those years that Roger Ebert was doing it, always wanted to. So yeah, this is going to be a treat, I think.
I haven't seen Rushmore since 1998.
Really?
No, I haven't. So
this will be great. Then.
Yeah, it's a perfect Sacred Cow topic then. It's one I remember having positive feelings about, but haven't seen now in almost 20 years. So I am going to be almost seeing it for the first time. I think I'm going to watch it, if not with both Holden and Sophie, with Holden, because I think Holden will really appreciate and really come to love Max Fisher and his sense of humor and his sense of rebellion.
Yeah.
I think he will really like the movie. So I'm excited about that. You know what I think of every time I think of Rushmore, way beyond any aspects of the story or the performances? I think of the soundtrack. And I know that's not a surprise to say about a Wes Anderson film, but especially because when I did the early incarnation of Film Spotting back in 2000-2001, Burn Hollywood Burn, my radio show at the University of Iowa, weekly two-hour show. That was a live show, not a podcast, of course, pre-podcast. But I used to use the Rushmore soundtrack pretty much exclusively. It was one of my like three go-tos for all of the show bumpers. So coming into the show, coming in and out of breaks, making time, all those great tunes I had to use from Rushmore. For whatever reason, those were just indelible in my
mind.
It's
right there for you. And the score itself is wonderful for that film. Okay, we talked about in terms of appropriateness for your kids when we did the Royal Tenenbaums.
That's right.
Do you remember the one bit of Rushmore that you just should recall?
I do, I think.
Hand jobs.
I think, yeah,
Adam.
Because you said it.
Lots of hand job talk.
You said it on the show, and that was the first time the word had ever been used, and I'm sure Sam's going to have to bleep it for radio.
Well, just wanted to remind you. Also should note, while I'm out in Boulder, we're going to try to pull off a Film Spotting meetup. So I know a couple of listeners
are planning
to go to the Interruptus anyway. I think they've done it before and made it sort of a tradition. So we're hoping to do that on Wednesday the 12th. But we'll put something up on the forum. I think Jeremy Doan, a listener, already has put something up on the forum. So check that out. We'll link to it. Otherwise, follow me on Twitter or Facebook, and I'll be mentioning it there once we get that settled. You can find me as Larson on Film.
At minimum, you should all go if you're in the area, because Josh is buying drinks after.
There you go.
They're on him. So
they're actually going to be on Film Spotting.
Yeah, they are. You are also Mr. Man About Town here in Chicago. You've got another little screening and event coming up here.
This is what happens
to plug
when you have a book to promote.
Mr. Free Time
all
of a sudden.
Of course. Yeah. No. Movies Are Prayers, June 13, is coming out. So I'm everywhere I can
be. That's actually the title, Movies Are Prayers, coming out June 13th.
Just the first part, Movies Are Prayers. So, yeah. So we are doing, this actually ties in pretty nicely with the theme of the book, a Heaven Can Wait screening. This is the 1943 Ernst Lubitsch film. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be May 6th at the Chicago Cultural Center, a morning screening and discussion, 10 a.m., free. So anybody, come on in, stop by. And it's presented by Music of the Baroque. This is going to lead up to their May 14 and 15 performances of the George Telemann Oratorio, Day of Judgment. So we're going to be exploring the afterlife themes. Maybe I'll bring in a little bit of the discovery
yeah,
here.
Maybe.
Maybe not. We're going to be just seeing how there might be some connections there shared between the oratorio and the film. So
you have to be a film critic and
a music critic
and a classical music critic. Theorist.
Not necessarily. I think I'm going to get some help from some of the experts connected to Music of the Baroque. I have listened to the piece a few times now on the road trip.
Well, that qualifies.
On the road trip, I said to the whole family, hey, we're going to put this on as we pass through Pennsylvania. Dad's got to do some research.
Yeah.
It's pretty intense. So I think there'll be a lot of stuff to explore there.
Okay. Well, if you want more information about that, we actually have a website. There will be much more about this coming soon, but there is a link. Forget filmspotting.net. We want you to go to filmspotting.org/events. That's where you will find.
Filmspotting.org/events.
Again, I'll explain more to you and our listeners later.
Catch me up on this.
Yeah, a lot more is coming with regard to our website. But right now, filmspotting.org/events. That's where you can get information about this May 6th screening of Heaven Can't Wait. It's also where you can find information about free passes we have to give away, and we have passes for Ben Wheatley's new film. It's called Free Fire. The screening is Thursday, April 13th here in Chicago, and you can have passes to see it before it comes out. Again, filmspotting.org/events. There may even be some other titles up there that you can enter to win passes for by the time you hear this. And another plug here, because we love so much of the programming at The Music Box, David Lynch, and I'm sure this was on my mind partly because of his ouster early from Film Spotting Madness. I was feeling bad about that, but also I think I sent this email to you when we got this announcement. I sent it to you and Sam and said, ah, for the days where I was single, no kids, you're living in the city, and you have time to participate in something like David Lynch, a complete retrospective at Chicago's The Music Box. It starts April 27th. They're going to screen all of Lynch's feature films, except Dune, presented in 35mm, and that all leads up to the May 5th debut of a new documentary about Lynch, David Lynch, The Art Life.
Not a bad consolation prize if you are disconsolate over him getting kicked out of Film Spotting Madness. Drawn your sorrows with how many of his films in a row? You think you could really do that?
No.
These are like intense films to take in.
But it's not really in a row, is it?
I think it's over the course of
a week or so.
Okay.
You got some time to process.
All right. There's probably
Lynch.
A couple in a row. I don't know which two Lynch films you'd want to see back to back.
Good
too
point.
Much.
And I don't know if that was a conscious decision not to show Dune or it was just because they couldn't get it in 35. I'm sure you can find more info about that. And we will link to more info about that in our show notes at filmspotting.net.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
All right, Josh, are you ready? We're going to get to the madness. You missed it last week. You heard it.
I did. I had to find out if
the show via podcast.
My predictive winner made it even to the final mm-hmm. four. It did.
It
I'm not going to say what that was because it might still have
here.
A chance to win.
Well,
I don't think
we're
going
to have to reveal it here as we get to the final four results. Again, we started with 64 films, actually 65 with our play-in game, Pantheon Films and Sacred Cow Reviews, like the one we're going to do for Rushmore, like the one we did with Casablanca. Last week in Casablanca was among those titles, actually made it to the Elite Eight because it's in the Film Spotting Pantheon. If you want more information about this whole process, episode 624 is the show that will reveal all. So we did get down to the final four last week. And as it turned out, Sam pointed this out to me last week, and it makes me feel pretty good, Josh. I think it validates a little bit. And again, this is all on our listeners, ultimately, though we also voted. But I think it validates Madness to an extent, because if you look at those final four films, 2001 A Space Odyssey, The Godfather, The Empire Strikes Back, and Pulp Fiction. It turned out we got a film from every decade from the 60s through the 90s. And you could argue, there's someone out there that would argue, I'm sure, that they're each the best films from their decade. I think The Empire Strikes Back would be the only one that people would argue with a little bit and say it's a fan favorite because it's Star Wars. But I'm sure lots of people would say The Godfather's the best of the 70s, 2001 is the best of the 60s, and Pulp Fiction is the best film of the 90s. I think we ended up pretty good here.
I just like the variety. I mean, some people were complaining along the way that it was getting a little stuffy, maybe too many classics, too many traditionalist choices, but this really mixes it up in a fun way.
Yeah, and speaking of that, Josh, Stephen Meyer in Monroe, Michigan wrote in, Pulp Fiction versus Empire Strikes Back is the undeserving populist choice, and Godfather versus 2001 is the dry establishment choice. It will be really weird if it comes down to Empire v. 2001 or Pulp Fiction v. Godfather. It will be weird if it comes down to any other combination, too. That's it. I'm moving to Canada.
That's the final straw for Steven.
Yep, madness.
It took film spotting madness. Okay.
That's it. That brings us to those matchups. It was in the final four, matchup one, The Godfather versus 2001, A Space Odyssey.
So here's The Godfather's road to the final four. It beat Young Frankenstein in round one, then Before Sunrise in round two, then Alien, big takedown there, I feel like, and Casablanca after that. Pretty impressive. 2001, here's who it had to beat thus far: To Kill a Mockingbird in round one, then Do the Right Thing. Oh, remember when
Back to the Future
was in this tournament?
It was the Cinderella.
It was so fun. Then it took down, here's the huge one, yep, Citizen Kane. 2001 took down Citizen Kane to pair off against The Godfather.
So we got some great feedback. Marcel Curran in Tauranga, New Zealand. I don't need the last surviving film to tell me a story about guns and gangsters, no matter how solid. I need something that reaches for the inexplicable and fills me with wonder. In other words, I need The Tree of Life. But since my number one film got monstered by a xenomorph, I'm voting for 2001. It is true that The Tree of Life lost to Alien in round one. It's confounding and beautiful, and for all its imperfections, it imprints itself upon you as only a great piece of art can. I know Don Corleone has probably already made Hal an offer he can't refuse, but my heart is firmly in space with also Sprach Zarathustra and The Acid Trip.
Now I'm just sad again about The Tree of Life.
I know.
I'm with you there, Marcel. Christopher Redmond from DearCastAndCrew.com. I was just emailing Christopher today about our top five lists of the
Okay. Yeah, the past 5 years for their show anniversary.
I'm glad we're on top of that.
Yeah, 5 years, youngsters.
Christopher says, Kubrick's 2001 is the godfather to all modern sci-fi movies. Coppola's The Godfather has probably spawned no less than 2001 imitators. Let's call it a tie for cultural influence. My decision comes down to evaluating form versus content. 2001 is a braver example of reinventing the form than The Godfather is at being a masterclass in content. Sorry, Corleone, but if I have my way, you'll be waking up next to an ape's head.
Well done. Josh Curtis in Seattle says, let's not kid ourselves. This matchup determines the winner of the whole tournament. Let Michael Corleone be known not only as the head of the mafia, but also the film spotting madness champion. Mm. The results, Josh, they do validate Josh Curtis.
Godfather is moving on with 56% of the vote.
Yeah, so The Godfather was the number one overall seed in the tournament. Obviously, Sam and I thought it had a good chance of winning it all or certainly getting to the championship game. But after 2001 made it to this point, I'm certainly not surprised it's as close as it was, 56-44. I actually thought 2001 had a shot. I really thought that we'd be sitting here saying it was a 51-49 2001 win, but that's not how it played out.
When you look at the titles it took down, it was on a roll.
Yeah.
No longer.
Well, let's get to matchup number two. It was Pulp Fiction versus The Empire Strikes Back.
So Pulp Fiction took out Cool Hand Luke, then Rio Bravo.
And then?
Then Goodfellas.
And then?
Godfather Part Two.
Wow.
Here's what Empire Strikes Back took down: Nightmare on Elm Street in round one. Not so tough, maybe. But how about Singing in the Rain?
Yeah.
Okay. Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
No Easy Task. And then Vertigo. This was the shock, I think.
I mean, these are worthy contenders.
Probably
here, if they
the
took
shock
those films
of the tournament, for me at least, is Empire Strikes Back taking down Vertigo.
Yeah. Miranda Roberts in Cleveland said, seriously, guys, let me guess. Oh, this is so good. You grew up sleeping in Star Wars jammies.
Check.
And had a Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs poster on your dorm room wall.
I avoided that one.
100% check.
You did? Okay.
And then, oh, she nails us even more, or nails me anyway. Sometime in the 90s, you used the phrase, Tarantino opened my eyes to the possibilities of cinema. I've said that in the past decade. I've said that in the past half decade. I might have said it 2 months ago.
I think you've said it in discussing Film Spotting Madness.
Maybe. But absolutely, she's got us pegged. And Miranda, size. I voted Pulp for the innovative structure, but if either of these beat 2001 or The Godfather, I am putting my money where my film snob mouth is and finding the 7 hours to watch Satan Tango. I love that she's going to punish herself
for this. That'll teach us, I guess. So did you have the Star Wars jammies?
Oh, Star Wars bed sheets.
Oh, I had the bed sheets. Yeah, bed sheets. Absolutely.
I probably had jammies, but I definitely had the Empire Strikes Back bed sheets.
Aaron Teachman in D.C. wrote in, I'm baffled by some of the weeping and gnashing of teeth I've seen about Empire's spot in the Final Four and about going up against Tarantino. I absolutely love that Empire Strikes Back has made it this far. And Empire versus Pulp Fiction is precisely the kind of matchup that I wanted out of this tournament. A beloved independent crime film against the best episode in the biggest movie franchise in history. What's not to love about that? The film spotting pantheon is not about choosing the greatest films ever, and this tournament isn't about choosing one movie that will sit in a vault as an avatar of film for all time. They're both about choosing movies that speak to us about what cinema is capable of showing us and making us feel. Empire is an epic movie full of towering personalities with an enduring mythology and personal and galactic stakes out the yin-yang. It's worthy of its place in the pantheon and in this tournament. I haven't hesitated to vote for Empire at any point, and that did not stop with this matchup. Pulp Fiction may be a groundbreaking, talky, quirky morality tale that I thoroughly enjoy, but it doesn't say cinema to me like Empire Strikes Back.
I think Aaron Teachman just said to Stephen Meyer, in your face, because
while wearing Star Wars jammies.
This tournament, I think, and the Final Four matchup. Jeff in Chicago. Having revisited both these movies in the past year, I was delighted by how much Pulp Fiction continues to surprise and shock me. It has aged fairly well and retains a kind of exuberance mixed with darkness that I've rarely found elsewhere. It remains, quite simply, my favorite Tarantino film, one I go back to again and again. That being said, The Empire Strikes Back was not only one of the most formative movies for me as a kid, but one that influenced the way I look at all movies I watch. So there you go, Miranda. It's not really about Quentin Tarantino. It's about Irwin Kirshner.
Poor Irwin Kirshner.
It was, for me, the original dark film, one that brought to life the reality that evil triumphs over good more often than we think. As Jewel says in Pulp, if my answers frighten you, then you should cease asking scary questions. My vote is for the Empire.
Mitchell in Chicago says, it's time to make this madness great again. Drain the Dagobah swamp and defund the sanctuary cloud city. Despite the title, Pulp Fiction is not hashtag fake news.
Wow. Marcel in New Zealand again. I've watched Pulp Fiction twice. I can't count the number of times I've watched Empire. Still, I voted Pulp Fiction. I loathe Tarantino's sadism, but his sheer creativity wins for its infectiousness. His joy in the craft of filmmaking is enough in this instance to tip the scales against the Rebel Alliance. My only regret is that if Pulp Fiction takes the film-spotting madness title, my kids will have to wait quite a few years before I can let them watch the only movie that is left standing in the bleak landscape of Adam's film apocalypse.
This is true. We should probably reiterate.
Yeah.
All movies are destroyed. And none other exist.
Nope.
Okay.
No.
Just want to make sure we had that still. Ben Spanner in Chicago. I thought about this matchup in the shower this morning. I thought about this matchup on the 290. I thought about this matchup walking to work in Pilsen. I'm thinking about this matchup now. Two movies from my childhood. One appropriately seen, Empire. The other seen under the cover of night, inches from the TV, afraid my parents would wake up and see that Zed's dead, baby. Zed's dead. In the end, I went for Empire. Not because I own Kenobi's lightsaber bought at Skywalker Ranch, but because in 2017, I need a life with Star Wars more than I need Travolta's ponytail.
Valid.
Sorry, Quentin, but... Oh, I wasn't prepared for this.
Oh, yeah. Oh. I was totally hoping that you would this because I can't do it. Semester Theater. You're going to try it? You really are fearless.
Luminous beings, are we? Not this crude matter.
Bravo, Josh Larson.
I don't think I got the last word, but that'll do.
That is a pretty good on-the-spot Yoda. I'm so impressed.
Thank you.
Jeff Post in Centennial, Colorado says, Empire. Not because of Darth Vader, Star Destroyers, giant asteroid worms, or Han Solo. Not because it's dark or because there's a twist involving Dad. It's because of Yoda.
More Yoda love.
Who, as a puppet with a goofy voice, is one of the most believable philosophers slash spiritual sorcerers ever depicted in film. Yoda wipes away the campy foolishness of Episode 4 with a gesture and lifts the entire franchise out of the pop culture blockbuster bog. He holds it for a moment with his eyes closed and you believe in magic. So that, and okay, Star Destroyers. Pulp Fiction is a blast, and it's an undeniably great movie, but I owe it nothing Imperial March plays.
One more note from Jason Eakin in L.A. This is the moment we find out just how much Film Spotting Nation loves Star Wars. Star Wars probably got their fathers, maybe even their older brothers, into movies, but it was Tarantino's early mid-90s Sundance crew that got a lot more of us into the movies. Pulp Fiction all the way. I think it could take this whole thing.
Well, will it have a shot, Josh, at taking the whole thing? The
Indeed.
Results.
Pulp Fiction with 55%. Empire only 45%. Jason knows Film Spotting Nation well, I guess.
I guess he does. And it turns out one of us may know Film Spotting Nation a little better than the other. So your championship contenders are The Godfather versus Pulp Fiction. And before we get into that a little bit, let's go ahead, Josh, and take a look at those bracket predictions. The competition you lost.
I am now the official loser this year as well.
You had no points in the Final Four round. You had Empire in the final against Raiders of the Lost Ark. You went adventure. You went fantasy.
Yeah.
Our listeners did not. Our listeners went dark crime.
Probably, to Jason's point, I should have skewed younger. Looking back at my predictions.
Okay.
That might have helped me out.
Yeah, you went more with our generation.
Right.
Exactly. Mike Merrigan, the founding father of Film Spotting Madness, he also didn't get any points out of the Final Four, though he had one film that made it into the Final Four. But he had The Godfather Part II versus Jaws in the championship match. Obviously, it did not play out that way. Me, now, I have 92 points, and I'm in second place. I have Pulp Fiction advancing to the final, and if it wins it all, I will vault ahead of Sam Van Hogren, despite the fact that right now he has 21 more points than me.
Yeah, that just doesn't seem fair.
He destroyed all of us in Film Spotting Madness Pantheon Edition. He had The Godfather advancing to the finals, which means the winner of the championship round, The Godfather or Pulp Fiction, will determine whether I win Film Spotting Madness or Sam wins Film Spotting Madness. And here's the thing. It doesn't really matter. It's really just for bragging rights, because the winner, as it sits right now, gets nothing. It's all about,
why have we constructed it this way? Where
it's all about the loser getting punished.
It's all about punishing, in both cases, now me.
Yeah. And
what am I watching?
Well,
Mission Impossible.
That's a really good question. So we suggested.
Didn't Michael suggest
that? We suggested a few shows ago that we were going to pick five movies among the worst of 2016.
Right.
We'd let listeners vote. So that was one option. We didn't follow through yet with that. And then last week, Michael suggested, off the top of his head, Mission to Moscow, Police Academy, like 6 or 9 or whatever.
Are we sure that movie exists?
No.
Before we commit to
no.
it?
No.
Okay.
But I thought that was a pretty good idea, and what Michael says should go around here. So I thought that was how we would do it. But behind the scenes, Josh, I will point out that Sam is just such a nice guy, and he's so positive all the time. He really doesn't like the idea of it being an actual punishment. He thinks that making you watch something like The Ridiculous Six, like you did last year, the Adam Sandler film, is just a complete waste of time. To which I say, yes, that's
well,
the point.
I would actually agree.
So he suggested that as the winners of this, me and Sam, we should just get together and pick a film. We get to choose one film from your blind spotting list, and that's the one we're going to force you to watch. But that's not a punishment. You know, you need to see those movies.
It's not as fun.
It's not, is it?
Come on. Give me something crappy.
I love it. Thank you, Josh. Because, yeah.
If I have a preference, I will say, give
me
something.
We're going to do the opposite?
Give me something from this year. So that at least I'm like, you know, keeping up with something that came out that's in the conversation. I mean, watching Mission to Moscow.
Okay.
Does me no good.
Let's do it. And I like listeners being part of it, too. They've been what drove Film Spotting Madness. So we
the
really
movies
should.
They've suffered through this year. I know the year's still young. But, you know, that. Maybe we should expand it to last year, because I don't know how many.
No, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
We do have a good list of films from last year that were pretty much reviled and seem pretty terrible.
Yeah.
And I think we could put together a good list and have our listeners vote. I think that's fair.
I appreciate the thought, Sam, but, you know, this is fine. I can take it.
There you have it. The Godfather or Pulp Fiction. I guess we're deciding best film ever.
Only film ever.
At least the only film ever. The movie you're going to rewatch for eternity, because it's the only movie that still exists. Vote now at filmspottingmadness.com. And if you use Twitter to work through the pain of having to make this choice, we'd appreciate it if you use the hashtag FSMadness.
Vous dormez dehors toute seule?
Ouais.
C'est par sport? Vous n'avez pas le choix?
C'est ça.
Vous n'avez pas de maison ?
Ouais, ouais, c'est ça.
Pas de famille où aller ?
Pas de trop.
Sandrine Bonnaire with Masha Mareel in Agnes Varda's Vagabond from 1985. Bonnaire, the vagabond of the title. Our Agnes Varda Marathon is sponsored by MUBI, cult classic independent films from around the world. Every day, MUBI's experts introduce you to a film they love, and you have a whole month to watch it. So there will always be 30 extraordinary films for you to enjoy. And listeners of Film Spotting get to try MUBI free for a month. Just go to MUBI.com/filmspotting. That's MUBI.com/filmspotting. Vagabond, another case, Josh, where we're jumping ahead almost a full decade in the career of Agnes Varda. We started with La Pointe Court from the 50s, jumped into the 60s with The Creatures, then to the 70s, 1977, for One Sings, The Other Doesn't, the last installment in our series. We discussed that movie a few weeks back, and now we jump ahead to 1985 for Vagabond, probably her most acclaimed film. I think you mentioned earlier Cleo from 5 to 7. That would be in the mix, one of her first real hits, but I think this film is one when people talk about Varda, it's in the top two or three always, if not the number one. And we didn't plan this because we didn't get this intricate into her career and how it all played out. But following One Sings, The Other Doesn't, the way we are, it is appropriate because this is the first feature-length fiction film she made after One Sings, The Other Doesn't. Everything in between were personal essays and documentaries, but not feature-length fiction. We certainly see in Vagabond the use and the influence of documentary techniques, which is something that we will see in the next film we get to in this series and the last two films, in fact, from Varda that will be part of this marathon. But I think following One Sings, The Other Doesn't worked well leading up to this film because I think there is a direct connection between these two movies in terms of some of the content. We discussed Apple, the hippie singer of One Sings. She's the one who sings, and she's the one who, for the most part, takes to this life of the road.
Yeah, she's just a vagabond herself.
Yeah, she's a bit of a vagabond, going town to town, singing, trying to make money as she can. And she very clearly doesn't want to be pinned down, at least at first, by domesticity. And later, as she becomes more domesticated, she rebels against that. And we talked about this. She's a character struggling to be a woman in this time and place. And both of those aspects are here in Vagabond. I wonder, Josh, how things might have been different for the main character of Vagabond if only she had had a friend like Suzanne, like Apple does, in One Sings, The Other Doesn't.
Does she want one?
Good question.
I mean, I feel like these are similar scenarios and two completely different characters, and more importantly, two completely different approaches to those characters, which is one of the fascinating things about Vagabond. I mean, this Mona here is really remains a mystery, except for the various prisms we see her through provided by the people in these documentary-like interviews we will probably get to. But here at the start, I just thought it was so compelling that she resists any sort of reading of her from the various people who pick her up and from the camera and from the film itself. And you could say, well, that sounds like it would be a problem. But in actuality, I think it's the key to the whole picture because this is not a movie that's looking at someone who is an outsider of society that people would either ignore or be curious about and expecting them to explain themselves, you know, which we've seen in other films. Our instinct is to say, how did she get on the road? Why is she on the road? And in fact, characters,
some people do ask her those questions.
Completely understandable. But Vagabond isn't interested in why she is, but who she is. And there's a distinct difference there. And I think by not asking her to explain herself, it really makes for a much richer film. At least that's how I experienced it. And I think it also makes for a very particular performance to watch by Bonaire here, because how do you play standoffishness in a way that's true to what it would be like in real life, but not lose the audience?
Yeah.
And she
not
doesn't.
Only that, not push the audience away, which can be compelling too, but in a way just be boring at some point.
Right. Exactly.
You just
where you lose
it because
interest.
It's one note.
I mean, and she really goes for the wanting to repel people away. I like her. How she responds when one woman picks her up and kind of recoils at the smell, she kind of gives the woman a look like, yeah, that's I smell so that you will stay away.
I'm dirty. Yeah,
I'm dirty. And yeah, and deal with it and I'm not going to change. And so she's really just, you know, Mona is, she's drifting through this world, yes, but she's also challenging it all the time. And she's ready for the hardships that come. She comes into every day swinging. Did you notice the one scene where she goes up to a water pump to fill her water bottle and her instinct is like the thing's probably broken?
Yeah.
She starts slamming on it right away. She doesn't test gently if it works, walks up to it and starts slamming on it. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how she lives life. Reasonable to be curious why, but I found this movie the better for it that it doesn't try to explain her.
Yeah, I'm with you. And you're right. She's ready for these obstacles and this adversity until she's not, until she finally can't overcome it. And that's where a lot of the tragic power of this movie comes from. I think the key for me in terms of understanding her character, if that's even the right word, because as you said, the movie sort of defies that in ways that I think are really compelling. It's an exchange early in the film. I think it's the first time we see a driver pick her up when she's hitchhiking, and he's just driving a pickup truck. And there is a moment where he makes a comment about a bed in the back, and it seems pretty innocuous, but she takes it for reasons we understand and will certainly understand later in the film. She takes it maybe a little bit as if he's suggesting that, oh, they could go back there, that there's some kind of exchange that needs to happen. But I don't think that's necessarily what he was saying or that Varda is implying that. What does happen, though, is she asks if he can turn the radio on or if he has a radio, and he doesn't. And she's just been given a ride from this guy. He's helping her out. And instead of saying, oh, that's too bad, I like to listen to music, she expresses herself bluntly and directly and says, basically, your truck is a piece of junk.
Right.
I can't believe you don't have a radio. You must be a real idiot. And he says, you know what? I'm going to let you out. This is my next stop. And her response to that is, oh, I see that this ride really isn't free. And again, it's not about, I think, some supposed sexual exchange. It's about the implication of that moment where she expresses herself, and it turns out that the real cost of this ride is her obedience, her approval, her willingness to not express herself, but to show gratitude and to go along with the choices he's made in his life. She's not willing to do that. And every one of these conversations, you talked about that prism, every one of the conversations that she has with these people, and we meet so many of them that cross paths with her. That's really what the film was about. Very clearly, Varda is riffing on Citizen Kane in a way, right? Where it opens with, I think we can say, it's the opening of the film, a dead body. And then it's about people telling stories about that person. And through those flashbacks, we get to a sense of who she really is. Of course, the difference is we're not going to have a Rosebud moment with this film, because that can happen in movies where there's some token, there's some symbol that could unlock what it all means and the key to understanding that character. Varda isn't going to do anything so simple.
And we should be even more explicit about this framing device, because here's where the documentary elements come in. In some cases, the people are actually reporting to the camera. Mm-hmm. Often we'll see that they're talking to someone who's maybe we see their shoulder and it's somewhat conversational.
Yeah.
But Mona is completely removed. This is after she's met them. So Varda essentially has gone back to visit these fictional characters and ask, tell me about this person you met. What was she like? And to go back to your example of that one driver, I think both things are at play. I do think there's a sexual suggestion there. Mm-hmm. And I mention that because it does become more explicit with someone else later on. And it's so fascinating to see how that guy describes her to the camera, where she's a conniver and possibly even dangerous, right? So that's one Mona we see through his eyes. Other people talk about the guilt they feel for not helping her more, and that's the presence that she had for them and that she left them with. Some people see her as this folk hero almost, you know, embracing freedom, and they're jealous of the life that she's leading. And the truth is probably she's a little bit all of these things. But what's interesting is, by the end, you get the sense that all of them, by the end of their lives, would say, this is one of the hallmark encounters I had in my life with this person, even if only lasted for 5 minutes. So we feel that impact that she has on people. And by the end of the film, when things do turn tragic, I think we start to realize that we've been impacted the same way, too.
Yeah, we have. Though the irony is, of course, that they feel that about her, but it's fair to say she doesn't feel that about any of them.
No.
Or maybe only one or two of them. It depends on how you interpret some of the scenes. But talking about that technique, I mentioned the documentary approach and the way Varda does shoot those. It's really interesting that we hear her voice, and I suspected this narrator's voice might actually be Varda, and it is. So we're hearing the filmmaker's voice saying, I set about to interview these people almost as if this really happened, as if this person really died and now I'm going to piece together who she was. And she shoots it like a documentary, but of course it is a fiction. That becomes pretty clear. And we don't see Varda really, or anyone else, directly asking the questions. Like you said, maybe there's a couple over the shoulder shots, but it's never really explicit who might be doing that. And Varda also decides to give only one of those characters, one of those people that she meets, Yolanda, the ability to turn to the camera whenever she wants and break the fourth wall, which is fascinating to me. She's the only one, and I think we could probably speculate on the reasons why, but those conversations that she gets in with these characters, those encounters become, I think, a sort of a transaction where she does always get something from them, tangible, in the form of a ride or some money or some food or sometimes all three, but they get something from her that's intangible. There's a legitimate sense that she's their conduit for seeing themselves as a really good person, as a better person, because they helped out this person in need. But honestly, I think it also just makes them less lonely. And loneliness is a theme that really runs through this film. But about her character and that mystery, the enigma that she is, she's never interested in being their companion. She's not going to serve that hole for them.
She really only encounters other people or chooses to encounter other people when she needs those things you mentioned. You know, otherwise, she is content to stay completely on her own. Now, as you're describing them seeing themselves, here's a point of connection with where I finally got to the end of the film. No shock, I'm probably not allowed to talk about this movie anymore because we put it in the pantheon, but Alhazar Balthazar came to mind not until the final end when things do take that turn and you start to see her, though of her own will, as this figure who's been passed around from one person to the other, and how they respond to her absolutely reveals essentially who they are. And this is where the mythic quality of the character comes in handy, because it allows us to enlarge in what's going on here beyond one person's travels. And I really think it gives Vagabond this, especially for its documentary form, this metaphysical quality and impact that you wouldn't expect when you're just describe what happens and how the film is shot. And so she really becomes, you know, Mona becomes, she's unseen by most of society, distinctly remembered by a handful. And in that way, she sort of stands in for this soul who has opened themselves up to the world. I know that seems to go against her personality a little bit, but she's giving that vulnerability in the way she lives. And then, you know, like Balthazar, she pays a price for it.
Yeah, she does. That's a great comparison because of the suffering angle, but because of the way she moves through all of these lives, the same way that donkey does. You notice about her as we're talking about the things that make her such a conundrum as a character. I kept waiting for the moment, despite the fact that her character seemed so solidified and I felt like I understood her as well as I possibly could. I knew what her convictions were. I knew what she was willing to do and what she was unwilling to do. I kept thinking, now's the time where we're going to hear her say, thank you. She actually never says it once. Josh, no matter how down on her luck she is in that moment, no matter how cold she is, and someone gives her a blanket or a place to stay or a ride or some money after giving her a food and a ride and all these other things, she never once says thank you. She never expresses a single bit of gratitude whatsoever. And I think beyond it being very clear that Varda wants to make her this conundrum of a character, I think it's as if she understands that she's being used by them in the way that I described. They're getting something from her. She doesn't look at it as, I'm just taking from you. She looks at it as, I'm taking from you. Yeah, but what did you take from me?
And it's an admission that she needs them.
Yes.
And she is not doing this and looking for charity. This is how she wants to live. So a thank you would absolutely be entering into some sort of social contract that she does not feel is necessary. It goes back to the radio bit, talking to the driver. That would be a pleasantry that she does not feel the need to engage in.
Despite all the bleakness of this film, there are some scenes that are genuinely touching. And I think one of them is the scene with the old woman who Yolanda is the cleaning lady for. And we see throughout the movie that she just sits in her chair, kind of muttering about what needs to be clean, basically just barking orders at Yolanda. She seems completely detached from reality other than the reality of making sure her home's really clean.
She can't see well.
She can't see well, exactly. And there's a scene where Yolanda leaves after taking Mona in, and Mona goes over and has a drink with her. Mona ends up basically getting drunk with the old lady, and they make a real connection, a connection that she really doesn't make with other characters, maybe any other character in the film. And it occurred to me, of course, that they are characters who are both on the fringes. They're outcasts in a way, ignored in their own house, abused or neglected or only spoken to when a transaction is taking place. That's the great joke.
By the grandson,
Grandson, where we learn that he always likes to come in and say, oh, you look like you're in such great shape today. And it's all a ruse. He's waiting for her to die. He wants the house. And similarly, she sees through that. The way Mona, I think, sees through a lot of what these other characters need from her.
Well, and there is no need from her by that older woman.
Exactly.
So they're meeting just as two souls.
Yeah.
As equals in a sense. I think that helps explain maybe the most promising. You know, Mona has opportunities for stability a handful of times on the road. And maybe this also explains why the most promising one she also turns down.
And we'll see
if this is the same group of people. I'm thinking of the family. They're sheep herders or goats, are they? And they're barely scrabbling by, but they have a farm, they have a herd, and they have some land. And they bring her in, very young family, young couple, and one child, and offer her some land. They offer her an actual trailer she can live in.
Yeah, and she can work the land and make some money, or at least provide her own food for herself.
Yeah. You know, so the guy who would be me, terrified of a life like this, is thinking, you've got it made. You know, you really fell in it here. Take it. And she gives it a try, but it doesn't work.
No.
I also love the shot that Varda includes in this of Mona looking out the window of her trailer and notice the flowery curtains on either side, like trying to make her look so suburban and domestic, right?
Yeah. While she's watching the wife do a lot of work.
Do the work.
And she's not willing to go out and do it.
It's like an ironic shot. And you clearly understand from there, this is not going to work. And indeed it doesn't.
No.
Now that husband is a fascinating character because he wants to know what we all want to know. He's peppering her with questions.
Right.
He's asking her
Why
doesn't
she have any ambition?
Her too that he had been on the road and warns her that you're going to have to get off the road if you want to survive, basically. And I love the description he gives of how his life turned out. He says, I chose a middle road between loneliness and freedom. And the way he says that, there's regret in his voice too, but also this sense of satisfaction. Like he's satisfied where he has ended up to a degree. When Mona can't get to that point, he really lashes out at her. And he says maybe the harshest words in the film, you're no dropout. You're just out. You don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that explains how a lot of people want to look at her. The people who don't actually engage to pick her up, either out of charity or exploitation, who just want to pass by and not see her at all. And I think this, you know, this idea of not seeing her is exactly where the movie starts. I just want to spend a minute on the opening shot, which is of this really picturesque farm field, trees on one side. You can see a tractor
working in the back.
Yeah, coming down towards the camera, clearly catching your eye. And we sit with it for a minute until Varda angles to the right a little bit and does this slow zoom into the corner of the field. And it's just a wonderful way to say, no. You're looking in the wrong spot.
Yeah.
Look over here. And that's where we find Mona, and that's where her life exists.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole movie is spending time in that sort of place.
Well, I think that's what we've seen throughout this entire marathon. You can go back to La Pointe Court and think about the way the camera moves and the way she'll draw your attention to the one thing in the frame that we probably weren't interested or didn't think we were interested in looking at.
Yeah.
That happens all the time here. And I think that these long tracking shots, a lot of these sequences begin with these long tracking shots when she's walking into a town or whatever the case may be. And they lull you a little bit into a sense of complacency as if everything is okay. And of course, we come to realize that everything isn't quite okay with her. But beyond that, then that stands out in contrast to the moments where the camera is moving gracefully through the space and the landscape, and then the camera will take us to a tree that's about to die, or these other shots that really, really make us think and really catch us off guard in the way I think provocative cinema should. You mentioned the farmer. I read somewhere today that farmer was a non-professional, like many people in this film are, and Varda made use of non-professional actors throughout her whole career, but was just a guy that basically lived that story. And Varda met him like on another film or shooting a documentary.
Sure looks it.
And then, and said, hey, I want to put you in this movie and you can kind of tell your story a little bit. But you know what the actual title of this film is in French? Because this gets to exactly what she's rebelling against with that farmer character. The full title is not Vagabond. It's Without Roof or Law, or No Roof, No Rules. And she simply was not going to be obedient to him, to the way of life that he had prescribed to her. That's not what this character is about. The scene and the connection I was thinking of that I think really is heart-wrenching and tragic in a way, is the relationship she strikes up with a farmer. I think he's Syrian, named Asun. And this is the one case where we get the symbolism, I think, of the scarf, this red scarf that stands out against this fairly bleak landscape. And she leaves it behind when she leaves him. It's something red. It's vital. Perhaps it represents love. But I think it's more just representing this kind of warm connection. She finally did it, Josh. In this one moment, there was something about that character where she bought into whatever truth he was selling her. And maybe he even believed it in the moment about the life they were going to have together. She'd always resisted that with any of these characters, this impulse to be tied down, to not be free, to be domesticated in any way. And she gives in there. And I think we give in a little bit with her, and we think maybe, I mean, we know because of the beginning of the film, but there's still this part of us, the magic of cinema, that thinks maybe this is going to be it. This is going to finally be her ticket to some kind of happiness, conventional happiness. And we see how it plays out, and the scarf is left behind. Once again, it just proves why she should never try to be anything but totally free.
Yeah. And why she should look at every interaction as a transaction.
Yes.
No matter what sort of hope
he
it might provide.
He got what he needed from her.
That use of the scarf and that departing mm-hmm. shot is, yeah, it's just beautiful.
Vagabond, obviously highly recommended by both of us, and it's available on various platforms, not to mention quite possibly your local library. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, email us feedback@filmspotting.net. As we mentioned, our Agnes Varda Marathon is sponsored by MUBI, cult classic independent films from around the world.
This week's highlights at MUBI include the final film in their Agnes Varda series. That's going to be one from 1988, Jane B. par Agnes V. So check that out if you've been enjoying the Varda films we've been talking about so far. Additional highlights at MUBI are two triple bills from contemporary award-winning filmmakers Volker Schlondorf and Ulrich Seidel from Germany and Austria, respectively. The Volker Schlondorf triple, a.k.a. Schlondorf, 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 is a trio of films by César and Palme d'Or winning Volker, yes, Schlondorf, a pioneering director of the new German cinema. They're also presenting the Paradise trilogy at Cannes, Venice, and Berlinale. Few films got MUBI's attention quite like Ulrich Seidel's acclaimed Unshakable Paradise trilogy, a series of radical, darkly comic stories about the search for happiness. All three chapters, they're titled Love, Faith, and Hope, are now showing at MUBI.
Sounds like a trio of films you may need to seek out, Josh. There are always 30 wonderful films to enjoy over at MUBI, all for only $4.99 a month. You can use their mobile apps as well to download films to watch offline, and our listeners can try MUBI free for a month. That website, once again, to redeem is MUBI.com/filmspotting. That is our show at filmspotting.net. Yes, it's still our website for now. You can find 12 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in our archives. While you're there, we hope you take part in the final round of Film Spotting Madness. 64 beloved films, only one will survive. If you haven't already, please check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show, and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both in iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
I already gobbled up the Next Picture episode that came out today on Alien. This after we did a Sacred Cow review of Alien, many years ago.
No, so, fairly recently.
Yeah, so I can't get enough of that film. Yeah. They had a great discussion on
inspired
it.
Inspired by the new movie Life,
yes.
Which seems very clearly inspired by Alien. So
quite clearly.
As of this taping, only part one of that discussion has come out. Part two will be out by the time anyone hears this. We encourage you to seek out The Next Picture Show again in iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. Out in wide release this weekend, Going in Style. Morgan Freeman, Michael Caine, and Alan Arkin rob a bank. It's directed by Zach Braff.
He's staying in the game.
He is. And Smurfs, The Lost Village. In limited release, Gifted. This is the Chris Evans movie, along with Octavia Spencer and Jenny Slate, a drama about a young math prodigy. And Your Name, from rising Japanese animator Makoto Shinkai. Two strangers find themselves linked in a bizarre way. When a connection forms, will distance be the only thing to keep them apart? I'm intrigued. I know there's been a lot of acclaim for Your Name. Next week, we will do another Sacred Cow discussion. It will be Wes Anderson's Rushmore. Josh, calling in from Colorado.
Yeah, we're going to have to give that a try. May not be a four-hour show.
No.
If I'm calling in. So we'll see what we can do. We'll definitely give plenty of time to Rushmore, though.
Yeah,
and we'll reveal the Madness
champion.
Champion.
We will. That's
I'll hang
right.
on the line for that to okay. hear, even though I've Thanks. Already lost and I really could care less
Before
at this point.
You go off to buy our listeners drinks, you'll do that part.
Yes.
There is more, though, on the show. We're going to have my interview with the director of American Anarchist. This is the new documentary from Charlie Siskel. He made the 2013 doc Finding Vivian Mayer. I'm really intrigued to talk to Charlie Siskel because I have seen American Anarchist. It's the movie about Bill Powell, who wrote the Anarchist Cookbook in the 60s. And I'm familiar with that book, familiar a little bit with its legacy. The movie certainly opens up a lot more that I was not aware of, and how Powell has wrestled with or not wrestled with the legacy of that book. I think we'll have a good conversation with Charlie about his approach to that film and his approach to the material and the character, the man that is Bill Powell.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at wbez.org. We are still looking for new reviews over at iTunes. If you can give us a rating or a brief review, that does help us reach new listeners. So take a few minutes to do that, please. Our music this week is by Alt J. It comes from the forthcoming album Relaxer. More information is at altjband.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Okay, I think we're good. Let's just do a quick, I can adjust as we talk here. We'll do a little hot mics. We haven't seen each other. It turns out we almost overlapped a little bit on trips to New York.
That was funny.
What else did you guys do? You were off for a week.
Well, you were asking about the Comedy Cellar. I was there, 3 days before you? What night were you there?
Thursday night last
week. Okay, we went Sunday night. Had to go, even if I'm in New York for only a couple days, which this was just, you know, quick run by. We did a triangle. We drove up there, see friends. Couple days down to DC to see my sister and then back after a couple of days. So we didn't see anybody huge in Comedy Cellar. They were all good. The usual sort of people who've shown up on, you know, late night shows here and there. It was fun as always. But you hit the jackpot.
I hit the jackpot. And we should set the table a little bit because how long ago was it? It was spring break last year, last summer?
Last summer.
Where you guys went to New York. You were determined to go to the Cellar.
Yeah.
You went to the Cellar, and you hit your own jackpot.
Double jackpot.
We told
jackpot.
This story on Hot Mics, but quick refresher for
Tracy
people
Morgan,
who don't remember.
Chris Rock.
There you go.
And neither of them were on the bill, as usually happens there. You know, there's usually not a huge name on the bill, but frequently someone will just stop by and kind of take over the stage. And yeah, that's what happened. It wasn't for our show. Our show had gotten out, and we were on the sidewalk hanging around, and Tracy Morgan pulls up in, I don't know what it was, but some major car.
So then you just tried to get back in.
So we talked our way back in.
Wow.
And at that point, we were just like, oh, can you believe Tracy Morgan? And then after he's done, the host is like, can you believe that just happened? What if Chris Rock showed up? And then he was like, ladies and gentlemen, Chris Rock. So yeah.
Yeah.
So it still hurts that you had your experience.
Really?
This is one of my, I had said, like, if I'd picked any, you know, top five guys or women or whoever would be it there, Tracy Morgan,
guy.
Chris Rock, and then, but your guy was at the top, probably.
Yeah, I was in New York for all of 24 hours and had only about 4 hours of actual free time. And in that free time, I said to my friend Chris, who I was with, I said, I was thinking about going to the Comedy Cellar. I've always wanted to go there. It's this famous place. And I told him about, my friend Josh, he went there, and who walks in? Tracy Morgan, Chris Rock. That's obviously a dream scenario. That's not going to happen tonight, but I just want to go anyway. I hear they usually have some good comedians. And I had checked online beforehand, and I was going to reserve online, but I didn't know what time we were going to get there after dinner, and I didn't want to reserve. We were going to miss it. So we showed up about 10:15, and there was a 10 o'clock show. And there was also an 11:30 show, but they called the 11:30 show the dirty show.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, okay, well, I'm cool with a dirty show, but does that mean it really is just gratuitously vulgar? Like, it's just about comedians getting on stage trying to kind of gross you out or be really sexual? If it is, maybe that's not as funny. Do I want to go to that show? Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure. We got there like at 10:15, and we tried to get in thinking maybe we could get in even though we were late for the 10 o'clock. And the guy said, no, we're all full.
Sure.
You can come back. We'll put you on standby for the 11:30. And we kind of talked about whether or not we even wanted to do it. And then we're like, yeah, we should.
We're here.
And so we hung out. We got on the standby list. We were pretty high on the standby list, so we felt pretty good. And I knew that we were at least going to see one big comedian that I'm a fan of, because listed on the website for the bill that night for the 11:30 show was Attell.
Dave Attell. Yeah.
So I'm like, I'm at least going to see Dave Attell. And if everyone else is okay,
sure,
I'll be fine. So we ended up getting called. We got seats right dead center in a perfect spot. Not the front row.
You don't want that.
I would never want that.
No.
I would never want that. But right behind them,
okay,
essentially.
That's good.
Dead center. And the MC went up and did his thing. And then the first comedian went up. And all the comedians on the bill, I'd never heard of any of them. But of course, they all have legit credits and TV appearances. And they were all really funny.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of them cracked me up. So it was a good bill. But after the first comedian goes up, our waiter comes by just actually as he's finishing up. And the waiter says, you guys got to make sure that you have your cell phones off. You can't get them out.
Good sign.
We've got a special guest coming.
Yeah.
And we're all kind of like, what's going on? Like, who could this be? And the MC goes up and he says, you know, this is one of those special things that the cellar is known for. This happens only here at the cellar, ladies and gentlemen, Louis C.K.
Oh.
And Louis walks up.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. And he does 20 minutes.
Really?
He does 20 minutes and he just kills.
Good.
Of course he does. He's Louis C.K., who I have seen before. I saw him at the Chicago Theater here a couple of years ago as part of the, what's it called, Just for Laughs, or
Just for Laughs,
I think, Comedy Fest.
Yeah.
So that was a great show. He's amazing. And actually, Chris and I, when we were standing outside, he said to me, this is an hour prior, he goes, so who's your guy? Like, if you had a favorite comedian, who would it be? And I go, gosh, that's so hard because I think a lot of guys are funny. But I'm like, probably Louis C.K. I mean, if I had to pick one that I'd want to see, I'd want to see Louis C.K. Not meaning I may see him later tonight. I, of course, did not think that was going to happen at all. It was just if I could see any time. Louis C.K. walked up, and yeah, he was working on some new material.
I was going to say, because he has something new right now.
Well, I mean, he said this at the end of the set, and it was in public, so I'm sure I'm not giving anything away, and maybe he was just kidding, but he did about 15 minutes, and then he said, that's what I'm working on for SNL.
Oh, okay.
And so he's already been on SNL, like, in the last year, but maybe he's going to be back on, and they haven't announced it yet. And he did that, and then he did another bit. He did his SNL stuff, and then he did something else. And I'm telling you, Josh, it's killing me, because I just remember thinking it was so unbelievably funny, even better than the 15 minutes before. Just this riff on something that annihilated me. I can't remember it.
Oh, man.
I can't remember what the premise was.
Man.
And I have no way of finding out what the premise was.
That's funny, because I was so tempted when Rock was going on to start taking notes.
Yeah.
And just because I had the same fear, like, this is by, let alone the next day, like a few months later, I'm not going to remember what. But I think especially there, you know, besides the fact that I would look like a complete nerd scribbling things down, that you just lose the, it's that immediacy of being there and the surprise. And sometimes they don't know what they're going to say because they're really just there to work on some stuff. And it's okay if it floats away. You had your moment.
Yeah, it really was about being in the moment with those comedians. I don't think I've ever laughed so much over 3 hours than that night. And I didn't even mention that, of course, Attell went on at the end of the night.
Okay.
Mostly just doing crowd work. I mean, he did some prepared stuff, it seemed, but then he just sat down behind that piano or whatever and just started riffing.
Nice.
And then he calls Artie Lang up.
Oh, wow.
And Artie Lang comes up, and the two of them for about a half an hour just stood there on stage and riffed and made fun of people and played off each other.
And it's so close, right? I mean, you're right there.
I had no idea from seeing
it. Like, you're
on
making eye contact with them.
I had no idea. I really thought, I knew it was intimate.
Yeah.
I didn't know you were that close.
Even if you're in the back. I mean,
no, there really is no back.
That's what's great about it. I love it.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.